One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Shawley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits, bringing you some of the best bits from the year that you might have missed. Now, with an election coming, this is going to be particularly handy, today's episode. Party political broadcasts have been around for nearly 100 years, featuring everything from men sitting woodenly behind desks to yogurt flying. Do they ever, though, change anyone's vote? And why are some of them so odd? Back in January, I spoke to Tory advertising legend Maurice Sarchi and the Labour filmmaker Mark Lucas to find out.
We are now following a party political broadcast on behalf of Party Political Broadcast.
Yes, a new year means a new slate of party political broadcasts. Those short films that TV channels have to show whether there's anyone watching or not, designed to give political parties each a fair crack at the whip by appealing to viewers at home. So last week we had Rishi Sunak surrounded by Union Jack flags and copyright-free music.
The government's priorities are your priorities, the people's priorities.
And this week, Keir Starmer apparently being interviewed just off camera by no one.
I grew up in a pebble dash semi. I'm sharing a bedroom with my brother, a bunk bed bedroom with my brother. My dad was a toolmaker and worked in a factory all his life.
In fact, party political broadcasts are almost 100 years old, having first been introduced for the general election of 1924, when each party leader had 20 minutes. Back then, the Labour Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, Conservative Stanley Baldwin and Herbert Asquith of the Liberal Party each made a speech unedited. The Labour minority government was defeated, with the Conservatives winning a landslide with a majority of 209. Back when it had a monopoly on broadcasting, the BBC actually used to make the broadcasts for the parties, offering up studios, equipment and staff. The first televised party political broadcast was in 1951, when Viscount Samuel, the Liberal leader, spoke directly into the camera for 15 minutes straight and still managed to run out of time. Cabinet Minister Sir Hartley Shawcross spoke for Labour, and Conservative Deputy Leader Anthony Eden spoke for the opposition.
Well, I would just like to say first that as an interviewer and as what I hope you will believe to be an unbiased member of the electorate, I'm most grateful to Mr. Anthony Eden for inviting me to cross-question him on the present political issues. I would like, too, to feel that I am asking, so far as possible, those questions which you yourselves would like to ask in my place. Well, now, Mr. Eden, with your very considerable experience of foreign affairs, it's quite obvious that I should start by asking you something about the international situation today, or perhaps you would prefer to talk about home. Which shall it be?
Well, you know, during this election, I found
in the election that followed, the Tories under Winston Churchill went on to oust Labour, winning a slim majority of 17 seats. By the end of the decade, party political broadcasts got slicker and snappier. This one from 1959 was billed on screen as a campaign report from Labour radio and TV operations room in London, fronted by Tony Benn, who's credited with transforming the staid model of party political broadcast.
This election is hotting up. The Tories are really badly shaken by the evidence of a Labour swing everywhere, and it's no wonder that they're lashing out. Tonight, we're going to examine their credentials, their record, their promises, and their performance.
By 1970, they were almost unrecognisable from those early speeches to camera, like this one from Labour called Political Challenge, funded by Bernard Donoghue, who went on to be an advisor to Howard Wilson and Jim Callaghan. It bore a lot of similarities to University Challenge.
This is a quiz programme and we have two teams competing who have been selected by an entirely independent research organisation. One team is of young, new voters who have never voted before at a general election. The others, the rest, have voted before.
Sometimes the mixture of politics and showbiz went a bit too far. In 1972, the Liberal Party got their leader to be interviewed, Question Time style, by Jimmy Savile.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome indeed to this party political broadcast. With a difference, if only the fact that I'm here for a start, but I am here to see Fair Play Speech, and it's the Liberal Party that have asked me to come along, together with lots of good friends here in the audience from all walks of life, and the object of the exercise is that they are going to put questions to Mr. Jeremy Thorpe.
By the end of the decade, campaigning was increasingly negative. In 1979, Margaret Thatcher made a bid for power with a party political broadcast based on a line attributed to the Labour Prime Minister, Jim Callaghan.
Crisis? What crisis? Crisis? What crisis? Crisis? What crisis?
Did you or did you not want better schooling for your children?
Guilty.
Now, did you or did you not want to buy your own home?
Guilty.
In 1987, Kinnock the Movie was a 10-minute biopic by Hugh Hudson, the director of the Oscar-winning Chariots of Fire. It focused on Labour leader Neil Kinnock as a family man, meeting old ladies for cups of tea or looking wistfully out to sea, rather than focusing on Labour's policies, which were still much more left-wing than the British public could stomach.
Why am I the first Kinnock in 1,000 generations to be able to get the university? Why is Glenys the first woman in her family in 1,000 generations to be able to get the university? Was it because all our predecessors were thick? Did they lack talent? Those people who could sing and play and recite and write poetry?
Artistically brilliant, no doubt, but Labour went on to lose the 87 election. 5 years later, the Conservatives tried the same trick with John Major, the movie. Directed by John Schlesinger, the Oscar-winning director of Midnight Cowboy, it took him on a wistful tour of his Brixton childhood home.
When I was in my mid-teens, we moved to Burton Road.
Where you see the house ahead, with the two white arches, immediately opposite there, that is where we lived. Now, is it still there? It is. It is. It's still there. It's still there. It's hardly changed.
It wasn't all positive, though. In the same election, the Conservatives launched a direct attack on what it called Labour's tax bombshell.
To pay for Labour's promises, the average taxpayer would end up being hit by an extra £1,000 tax bill.
While Labour went with Jennifer's Ear, a video soundtracked only by music, contrasting two young girls with earache, one of whom could go private, and the other just had to wait.
Someone will wait eternally.
In 1997, Labour produced a film called Land of Hope and Glory. It was just Elgar playing over footage of the Conservative Party conference with captions saying, just imagine what would happen if the Tories got in again, or just imagine what the Tories would do with another 5 years. Well, a huge row blew up, and as a result, the rules were changed so that parties now cannot use moving footage of political opponents, but they are allowed to use undistorted stills. So how do you navigate all those rules and produce something memorable without being embarrassing, powerful, without landing yourself in hot water? So I'm now joined by Mark Lucas, who worked on Labour Party political broadcast in 1997, 2001, 2005, and the slightly less successful 2010. Hiya, Mark.
Hi, thanks very much for that introduction. They always get my opinion, but there we are.
Good to have you with us. And Maurice Saatchi, Lord Saatchi, of course, a long-time Conservative Party advertising guru over, what, the best part of half a century, Maurice?
If you insist on reminding me, yes.
What was the first party political broadcast you worked on, Maurice, that you can remember? Because they've changed so much.
I truly don't remember, but all of the work that we did with the Conservative Party has landed me in a situation in which I'm afraid my contribution to British politics is entirely negative. Professor David Butler said to me, to my face, "You, Boris Saatchi, are personally responsible for reducing all British elections to negative campaigning." And well, that was very hard to take, but it's also completely true. our approach to party political broadcast or any other form of election campaigning was, and still is, entirely negative.
And that's because there was sort of, in essence, two sorts of party political broadcast. There's the hopey, changey one where maybe the party leader walks around in the sunshine, high-fiving members of the public and talking about how lovely things are going to be if they're in number 10 after the election. And then there's the don't put the other lot in, everything will collapse, you'll all be homeless, there'll be rats on the street and everything will be a nightmare. And you possibly specialised more in the latter. Mark, in the sort of the new Labour years, you were a bit more hopey, changey, weren't you? Especially in 1997.
Well, look, I'm in danger of agreeing with Maurice in a way because, yeah, the most effective ads in general that we did were full-on attacks. And I don't think we ever did an ad where we didn't say afterwards, God, I wish we'd gone a bit further. So, you know, I'm fully aligned with that. But in 97 in particular, we were doing a slightly different thing or an additional thing. I mean, look, for an opposition, where do you want to get to? You ideally want to get to change without risk, don't you? Because risky change doesn't sound all that good to anyone. And a change that's basically the same isn't that appealing. And so all of the ads that we did in 97 in particular had a sort of theatre to them and a kind of feel and a vibe to them. I mean, we had an ad with a Pete Postlethwaite turned into an angel, you know, replete with wings. And we had another one where a bulldog, you know, marches off to a brighter future. So we tried to be, there was a sense of theatre to them. But behind that, we're actually saying, you know, look, we're okay, we're safe, you can trust us. In a funny way, because the party broadcast, there's been a demise in the sense that the viewing figures are down, they're marginalised, you know, went in 97. They were all on the telly at the same time. You couldn't avoid them unless you sort of left the room. And now they're much more easily avoidable.
Although I suppose actually one of the things that they now live on social media and get reshared and that sort of thing. So they might be viewed less on the telly, but they get sort of legs elsewhere. I want to ask you both for sort of the ads that the party political broadcast you're most proud of and the one you'd rather we forgot. Let's start with you first of all, Maurice.
They're all our work was magnificent. And we were, by the way, if you'd like further criticism of myself, you see how humble I am. We were also greatly criticised, apart from all this negative campaigning. We were also, which ruined British politics, I'm told. We were also criticised for cheap sloganising. In other words, treating people like morons by only giving them three words. But I don't accept that either. I think that's also, for me, a source of pride on the basis that, so far as I can tell, the most powerful rallying cries in history that changed the world are very simple and to the point. For example, your country needs you. No taxation without representation. One man, one vote. There was nothing complicated, was there, about liberté, égalité, fraternité. And by the way, in case you're interested in the Ten Commandments, the average length of the Ten Commandments is seven words.
What about you, Mark? Is it the Pete Postlethwaite one?
I mean, the Pete Postlethwaite one was amazing. Poor old Pete. He was drunk through the whole shoot, by the way. And Stephen Frears and I had to basically get on our knees and beg him to leave the caravan to actually do the scene. He had a sort of last minute, as angels sort of do, a last minute worry about New Labour and whether it was all real, which we were fortunately able to reassure him that it all completely was. So that was a memorable one. But the one I'd pick, if I had to pick one, I think was the bulldog one. So we cast a bulldog, Tony Blair speaks, poor old British bulldog has been, you know, let down by the Tories for many years. What, you know, hears Tony speak, gets excited and gets up and walks off towards a great future. And the reason why I remember it is not so much the film, but the press conference that followed it. Because on the morning of it, Peter Mandelson came up to me and said, "Mark, I think I would like to have the dog with me for the press conference." So, really? Yeah. So it was the first dog and politician press conference, certainly of that campaign. So I had to drive off and get this bloomin' dog that we'd used in the film, which I managed to do, drive it back to Millbank. And there were 300 journalists outside waiting for this moment. We actually drive in with a hood over the dog so that it was like sort of paparazzi style, that they didn't get a photo of it in advance. Peter walks out with the dog. It's like one of those more sort of surreal moments of a campaign. And the owner just turns to me and says, "There's something I should have said earlier." And I went, "Oh my God, what is it?" You know, and he went, "Well, I am really worried. British bulldogs are bred with a congenital heart disease, and my one is really prone to heart attacks. So the one thing I can't do is let him have any stress." And this was revealed as Peter's walking out to the, you know, it was front page of the Sun, 300 media out there. And so I've just occasionally wake up in the middle of the night with this image of a heart attack dog, you know, with the four paws up in the air and Peter trying to resuscitate it as the sort of image of the campaign. So I'll never forget that because it got so much media. It was claiming a British icon, but also for me, it was, you know, kind of terrifying really as an experience.
In fact, Mark, I do know a bit about the bulldog because of a conversation I had a few years ago with Philip Webster, former Times political editor, and James Landell, who was on the Times, is now at the BBC.
Tory party at the time was in total disarray, and they got this lion that they campaigned with a lion. They used it as a symbol, the symbol of the lion, and they used this picture of a lion in all kinds of broadcasts and things. And one of our colleagues who's not here today but who was with us discovered that the lion was gay. Do you remember the name?
The other animal was the Labour Party got a bulldog called Buster, who was there to, which they used for some of their promotional material, which was designed to sort of show how patriotic they were. Because, of course, sort of foreign affairs was always seen as one of Labour's weak points. They wanted to try and sort of tickle that up. So Peter Mandelson arranged for this dog to be photographed. But it subsequently turned out that the nether regions of this dog had been airbrushed out for fear of offending the voters, which caused a bit of fun.
So, Mark, do you remember all of that?
Yeah, there were two rumours, actually. The first rumour that probably Morris put out was that the British bulldog was actually German and was called Fritz. And we had to go around and reassure people that wasn't the case. And then the second rumour was that Peter had objected to the size and the movement of the poor bulldog's dangly bits because it was distracting from what Tony said and therefore ordered that they be airbrushed out. And that rumour was completely true. Yeah, that was absolutely true.
That was Mark Lucas, who worked on Labour Party political broadcasts in 1997, 2001, 2005 and 2010. And Maurice Saatchi, Lord Saatchi, spent half a century advising the Conservative government. His book, Do Not Resuscitate, The Life and Afterlife of Maurice Saatchi, is out now. Here he is giving it the sales pitch.
It reveals the biggest secret of all time. Why some people go to heaven and others go to hell. And I was able to perform this miracle because after my death, when I arrived, as one does, at the gates of heaven, seeking entry to heaven, it was worse than arriving at Heathrow.
Ever the ad man. So those were the spin doctors working for the political parties, but for the people actually making the film, it could be even trickier. Parties often want normal, hard-working families rather than politicians behind a desk. But it can be tricky to keep the public on message. Nick Frost is a TV producer and director of the production company Middle Table. He's worked on multiple political broadcasts for different parties and referendum campaigns. So, Nick, explain the pitfalls that you can face when you start involving real people.
Well, part of the problem with finding real people is that real people have real problems. And what you'd ideally do in this sense is get a sense of who you should be interviewing in the first place and whether they have any problematic backgrounds. But that doesn't always happen. In the middle of an election cycle, there's a million things happening at once. So everything sort of happens at the same time. We were on the way back from filming in a factory in South Wales once, really pleased with it. It was going to be a big part of this particular broadcast, of this particular film. And we'd filmed this bunch of workers all getting on with their lives, you know, working together, and it was a really good, and we were in the car on the way back, we got a call from headquarters saying, did you film such and such a person? And we said, well, yes, actually they were sort of in most of the shots, and they said, unfortunately, we've been doing some background checks on them and we can't use them because they've got convictions related to paedophilia. So that was out of the window straight away onto finding a new factory.
Wow. And I suppose that is the pitfall, because that's exactly the sort of thing that journalists like me would do, is immediately start working out, well, who are all these people? There's the political party, there's maybe the agency they're using, there's, you know, the spin doctor on the ground, there's the people looking after the actors or the members of the public. There must be a lot of tension there. And you're just trying to get on and do the thing that you think would be good, while loads of people who don't normally make films are telling you what they want instead.
You know, there was one particular occasion we were working with a party, and they'd been working with a big agency throughout the campaign, and the relationship had been breaking down and down and down to the point where they were sort of very annoyed with each other. And we were on one particular shoot that had actually been the idea of the agency. Sitting across the table for them, and one of the executives asked me to go and get a sandwich for him, and I didn't mind, I was going out to get lunch anyway, got them a sandwich and handed it over. Somehow this got back to the comms team at the party, and they said they shouldn't be asking you to do this, you're not their footman, you know, you are a production team, this is it. And then they forbade the agency from dealing with us directly, so we had this ridiculous situation of us sitting at a table at the shoot across the people, the execs from this agency, and they weren't allowed to speak to us. They had to send a message back to the headquarters, who then may or may not pass that message on back to us. Common sense told in the end, and we ended up sort of, you know, working things out, but gives you an idea of the tension and the frustrations that can set in.
And obviously, months in advance, people will know that they've got a slot on, it's on BBC One, it's 5 to 7. How long in advance are you doing that? Or is it like right down to the wire?
As the campaign rolls on, everything goes off the rails, and you know, right up to the wire and even beyond it. And, you know, you'll push and push and push that deadline back. I remember one particular time we were in the post-production suite and, you know, we were several days past the deadline. We were being harangued by the broadcasters. Where is it? Where's it gone? And we were just about to send it to them. And I got a phone call from headquarters again. Can we change a shot? So which one do you want to change? This is a shot that's been in since the beginning. It was a shot of a worker who'd taken out a pen. And they'd given the pen a shake to get the ink flowing, but it was seen within the party headquarters that this could be construed as a rude hand gesture, and that it could be clipped up by someone, you know, opposite to the party, and used on social media to say, here's what this person thinks of this particular party, can we change a shot? And so we had to go back, find the rushes, change the shot, go through the process, you know, all the while the broadcast's on the phone. It gives you an idea of the paranoia, I think, that sets in as a result of people like, let's be honest, you.
Nick Foster.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. and they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So never mind the politics. Do party political broadcasts make good TV?
So what we thought we'd do is have a trawl through some of your favourites. I was on Twitter earlier in the week asking for some of your all-time favourites. We've put together a sort of top five. And we thought, well, who better to cast a critical eye over than the Times television reviewer, Carol Midgley, who joins us now. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Matt. You okay?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm not bad, thank you.
So we've torn you away from all the good telly to get you to watch some old party political. Have you ever reviewed a party political broadcast before? This feels like the sort of thing the paper might
do.
No.
I never have. This is a first, a personal first.
Well, there we are. So, should we just dive? Let's just dive straight in and we'll see how we get
your
on.
Expectations low.
We get unpacking them. And we've sort of been through all some of the sort of serious ones. We heard Jennifer's Ear and all those sort of ones before. But these are some of the ones that sort of stood out, either for their creativity or because they were so wincingly awful. So let's start with the top five. So actually, 1993, so this is under John Smith, Labour Party drafted in Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. So you'd think, you know, that's pretty good. You know, two hot comedians at the moment, for party political broadcasts, where they basically play posh Tories helping their friends find tax avoidance loopholes. Let's just take a quick listen.
Lord Rupert Shaffington Crag, sir.
Rupert! Brandy and soda?
Good God, no, it's too early in the day. For soda.
Sit down. Now, as I recall, your problem is the little matter of your death. How to leave the entire county and associated businesses to Lord Rupert the Younger without those nasty little taxmen getting involved. Any ideas?
Can't see a problem, Rupert. Just bundle up the capital gains tax and the inheritance tax into one parcel and you get double tax relief. Just leave it all to me.
Just leave it all to us.
Double tax relief? I don't believe it. Just imagine a...
The deer seems to have died. Smart move.
So that's Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. Now, what did you think of this, Cal?
Well, actually, I thought that it was... Obviously, you could tell from that. It's very slick, very well written. But I think it's kind of, for a party political broadcast, kind of too clever for its own good. Because it's if you were already a Labour voter, you've got to think a bit of its impact, haven't you? What's the point of a party? You're trying to persuade people to vote or to support you. If you're already a Labour voter, you'd think, ha-ha, very funny, and it is funny. It is. But if you were Tory or you weren't sure, it might just play into the hands of going, oh, there they are, smug lovies, hitting the same old stereotypical targets. Everyone's, it's all about tax loopholes for the rich. They make some really good points, especially about like the little people are paying all the tax and so the rich people can get away with it. But I just wonder if you just switched it on halfway through, you might think it's a sketch from a bit of Fry and Laurie and not realise.
And one that, I mean, it's quite funny, but not as funny as the actual, but some of the stuff from a bit of Fry and Laurie. I can't remember why.
Yes.
I sort of acquired some DVDs of them once and sort of ploughed through it and just adored it. And there was part of me that thought, obviously, normally when, writing sketches, the gag is king, or it should be.
Yes.
And if you make a point along the way, then great. But clearly with this, making the point is sort of king. And it became a bit late. I probably thought it was a bit long as well
It was too repetitive. It was too repetitive. So there was like four different scenarios. And it less is more with party political broadcasts. And you need to keep it sharp and to the point. And it went on far too long, yes.
It reminded me a bit of one, which I really struggled to find. I think because it just fell... Anything around 2010 has just sort of dropped out of the internet for some reason. But it was in the 2010 election... the Labour Party did one mocking David Cameron and the Big Society, and it was a sort of a mum came in. She was sort of dressed as a lollipop lady, taking off a lollipop lady outfit, and so I was like, "Oh God, I can't stop and talk. I've got to go and run the army next or something." And it was very funny.
Yes.
But all it really did was, "Yeah, that's quite funny." It was like a good satirical sketch. I'm not sure it really persuaded, but it clearly didn't work because the Labour Party went on to lose in 2010. Right, look, this is another one from 2010. An absolute treat, this one. A trip down memory lane. This is from the Lib Dems party political broadcast in 2010. I think perhaps no party political broadcast thrown back at a party quite so dramatically. No. This is Nick Clegg walking among sort of windswept landscapes, council house high rises, with lots of bits of paper fluttering around, which have got broken promises written on it, with lots of sort of weird ethereal music. Let's take a listen.
Broken promises. There have been too many in the last few years, too many in the last 30 years. In fact, our nation has been littered with them, a trail of broken promises. You remember them? Fairer taxes, a promise broken. Better schools for everyone, a promise broken. Cleaner politics, a promise broken. I believe it's time to do things differently. I believe it's time for fairness in Britain. I believe it's time for promises to be kept.
No sniggering at the back. What? I suppose in and of itself, Carol, this is quite good in 2010.
Yeah, well, obviously the phrase doesn't age well was created for this broadcast. And the irony klaxon, of course, is going off with the benefit of hindsight. But at the time, no one knew, did they? No one knew that he was going to do his reverse thing on tuition fees and have to apologise for breaking a promise. So we didn't know that. So I think in terms of an actual piece of film, it's just, obviously you can't see because it's radio, but it's just a single camera, him walking in his big winter overcoat. And it's like, here, look at me, I'm stripped down, Nick. No gimmicks, no bells and whistles. It's just me talking to you. And it must have worked because people obviously believed him because he ended up being in the coalition.
Yeah.
So as a piece of television, it was probably effective.
Yeah. My favourite bit is at the very beginning, it starts with a piece of paper and it says like Labour promised to scrap tuition fees or something. Yeah. And that sort of flutters away. So it's like, it's so on the nose from obviously the Lib Dems then went on to treble tuition fees. Well, let's move on to the next one. Number three in our countdown. And actually, this is proper one for pop pickers. A memorable effort for the Green Party in 2015, where they put together the boy band that nobody asks for. David Cameron, Nick Clegg, Ed Miliband and Nigel Farage. Singing in perfect harmony. Do you get it? Because they're all so similar. Let's take a listen. Do you know what, this is just taking me back to working at Mail Online and listening to this about every 5 minutes. I remember thinking this was really smart. It was very slickly done. Yes. It was quite funny. As a piece of... capitalising on getting 3 minutes on the telly, I thought it was pretty good.
It was really good. And it was like sounded... It was very, very... creative and imaginative, because it you know, obviously the gag being they're all the same, this just homogenous boy band lookalikes where they all sing from the same sheet, then that, you know, you can put a cigarette paper between them all and the Green Party's different. I think it was really successful for that. Obviously not that successful, but given what the, you know, didn't win that many seats, but I think, you know, it reminded me of that. I don't know if fans of Father Ted, it reminded me of when Father Dick Byrne went in the Eurovision Song Contest, and it was that kind of song. And I just thought it was just really clever for that.
Well, I suppose what's so good is it was a really clever political point executed. Yes. Really well, like high production values. It looked great. And actually, it got shared a lot. It got talked about a lot. It made the papers, it made columns, and, you know, and it was all people in on the joke rather than sort of laughing at them.
And a catchy tune, which is important, you know, for people to remember.
Whereas in 2019, the Conservatives went for, well, I think this was based with a Vanity Fair, sort of 12 questions that Vanity Fair ask. It's a sort of your Birdman meets The Office style video. Boris Johnson wandering around the Tory election offices, answering this sort of weird list of questions and just making random jokes.
Hey, Boris, you all right?
I'm good. How are you?
What's been on your mind today?
Well, I can't hide it from you. I've been thinking a bit about this general election campaign.
And how do you typically start your day?
I tend to get up pretty early and then I go down and take the dog for a walk and dog does his business and so on and so forth. That's my start to the day.
Yeah, and on it went. If you thought that was a bit thin on politics, it got worse. The main memory of this cow was a massive row about the way he made his tea. That he put milk on top of a tea bag and then the water.
Yes, I didn't use the kettle, did he? He used a hot tap.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, was it effective in 2019? They obviously won a majority, so in that sense it worked. What did you make of it as a piece of telly?
I thought it was awful to watch, but actually quite effective. I mean, that handheld camera slightly shaky. Here I am walking through, ordinary guy taking the dog out to do his business. You know, I cooked steak and oven chips last night. I mean, the desperateness to appear I'm normal just like you was palpable. But I think he was slightly copying the Nick Clegg thing in a way.
Yeah.
You know, 9 years earlier. It's like, hey, what you see with me is what you get. I'm just a straightforward guy. I answer straight questions. Rolling Stones and The Clash are my favourite band. You know, everyone, those awful questions that people ask politicians. But look at what happened afterwards. Yeah. It must have worked because, you know, people must have watched and thought, do you know what? That's a man who tells the truth. He's a straight talker.
And actually, the thing about that campaign, the Tories posted a whole load of rubbish online and all people talked about was the rubbish that was posted online and then people went and found it and probably did reinforce. They were getting their message across because people were sharing, going, have you seen this? And then actually they were sharing their messages. Finally, though, I think this has got to be my number one favourite party political broadcast. It's the Natural Law Party's broadcast ahead of some European Parliament elections. Their leader, Dr. Geoffrey Clements, staring hypnotically into the camera, said the party's first priority was to set out a programme of transcendental meditation and yogic flying, which is where you sort of sit cross-legged and then sort of catapult yourself into the air. It's hard to explain. We'll play a clip, but I recommend you spend 5 minutes later on today watching it. But let's take a listen.
When a person practices transcendental meditation and yogic flying, a high degree of integration is produced in brain activity. The person experiences bubbling bliss and stress is dissolved. This is the basis of many practical results in every area of life. Through a group of 7,000 experts in yogic flying, this effect of coherence radiates to the whole nation, bringing down stress and negativity in society and making the nation strong, dynamic and integrated.
It's a shame that you can't really imagine a sort of, well, it looks like a room in a sort of stately home with mattresses on the floor and people in their yoga kit, cross-legged, catapulting themselves into the air. And apparently, if lots of people do that, waves of calm will sweep the country.
Yes. And later on, yes, he claimed that because there was a yogic flying sort of scene in Skelmersdale in Merseyside, and they claimed that it reduced crime by 60% in Merseyside in between 1987 and 94, which is quite a bold claim, isn't it? The level of crime at the time in the 80s. But I thought even funnier was the man who presented that, who can't see. He was like sitting in a beige suit, he had a Tom Selleck mustache, a beige suit, and he looked like he was made in the Soviet bloc in 1972, even though it was 1994. And there was like this is what people do when they suspect that you think they're talking rubbish. They try and have an Open University kind of gravitas about it. So he's addressing the camera like it's a lecture, a science lecture.
It had real sort of like Open University vibes about it. It was incredible.
Like lecture.
Yeah.
And no sense of humour whatsoever, not a scintilla of humour in it.
Which made it all the better. Yeah, Hugo Rifkin, after I tweeted about Party Political Broadcast of the Week, Hugo Rifkin tweeted, never forgot this, everybody saw it, had the entirety of the UK going, WTF was that the next day?
Yes.
It's incredible. I've just tweeted a link to it, so you want to go and have a look. Carol, thank you so much for wasting your morning by watching all of those for no reason other than a trip down memory lane. And if you like that sort of thing, you're going to love my Times Radio show weekdays from 10. I'm back in January. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.